Welcome to Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George. And today, I mean, this year, and Happy New Year, by the way, I think it's time to start talking about solutions. We already know what the problem is. The problem is a healthcare system that's bankrupt, bloated, is all about treating disease as opposed to keeping people out of the hospital. And it's now been, I think, hijacked by various interests who whole design is to keep people on some medication once a day for the rest of their life to manage their medical problems while creating a system where more people fall into the, you know, the diagnosis of a particular medical problem. And we've now seen obesity become a disease. And I'm sure that's only the beginning, since they have pills that can control and supposedly palliate everything. I think this is going to be the beginning of like a tip of an iceberg. So today, I'm honored and really happy to have a colleague on with me today, Dr. Nicholas Beaulieu from the Highland Personal Health. Actually, he has two tracks to his practice, and he's the future. It's about functional medicine. It's about cellular diagnosis, you know, the cellular cause of disease. It's better to prevent the disease altogether than to try to treat it after the fact. And Dr. Nick is one of the pioneers of this. And I've worked with him for the last 2 or 3 years, and I'm just very amazed and, you know, impressed about the way he treats his patients. And I wanted everybody to listen to what you could have as a doctor when you go to see somebody, that most people settle. And they just get someone who comes in there for 2 minutes, walks out the door, doesn't even know them, their family, doesn't have any personal investment in the patient, which to me is the art of medicine. And when you have that, that connection is part and parcel to getting healthy. And Dr. Nick lives by that. So with that introduction, Dr. Nick, welcome to the show today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I aspire to those lofty statements. Thank you, Elena.
Well, you know, you're living them. That's the important part. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a family practice trained physician. Did my undergraduate at University of Miami, went to Morehouse School of Medicine for medical school, and wanted to do an urban family practice residency program, which led me to the West Coast and did a residency program in Los Angeles at California Hospital Medical Center, which prepared me not for the traditional family practice rural role, but more for the urban communities that is really where I live here in Atlanta now, in downtown in the Virginia Highlands area, and where I practice.
Now, that's an unusual track. Most people, or at least most people, think that most doctors want to become surgeons and plastic surgeons, and it's all about the money. What exactly made you want to take this track? Because it is a little unusual.
Well, you know, before I started medical school, I was family practice. I wanted to do this the entire time, partly, you know, out of a fair amount of ADHD and the inability to concentrate on one particular thing. I thought I'd be bored if I looked at one particular aspect of health or disease. Mm-hmm. And really am fascinated by people and cultures. And the anthropologic parts of medicine are sometimes the most interesting for me. And I really am a people person, and I like the people. And I think as we specialized more and more in medicine, we lose track of the people. And it's our systems, you know, we approach medicine by breaking down a human into a bunch of organ systems. And it's that reductionist mentality that I think has put us where we are now, because there really is nobody who can reassemble a human to go back and to look at all the factors that contribute to disease, because there are so many. There isn't one organ system. There isn't one disease. There's a person who has a multitude of issues that are going to lead to disease. And particularly as we live longer, we have this concept of chronic disease and the idea that we have to live with chronic disease and that we can only palliate the symptoms. And I think that goes back to that reductionist mentality where we're breaking people down to organ systems and not looking at people as a whole, as a lifestyle, as, you know, the food that they assimilate, the toxins that they're able to eliminate. And that's sort of where my entire framework as I approach my patients meets functional medicine, where functional medicine goes back to function and not a reductionist idea that there is the one thing. And I think you might agree, Elena, but there is no one thing that mm-hmm. makes people ill. There's only
That's
a multitude
true.
Of things. And having that sense of a broader picture allows you to treat a patient in a more effective manner.
Now, as a family practice physician, you were in the system. You saw how your other colleagues practiced. Did you get any pushback? You know, I know that you're, like me, you're a talker, so you were, I'm sure, sharing your ideas with your colleagues. What did they think when you started to think, or really talk about, you know, not just put them on a medication and manage it, but to actually stop the process and cure them? Did you get pushback from that?
Well, I think there's a general consensus among physicians, and part of it is a resignation that there's nothing that we can do. I can do my part. The patient certainly has a responsibility, but this is the best that we have. And I think that is part and parcel of where physicians are right now. They're very reactive. They've been beaten by so many factors, and many of them economic in the system, but a lot of them just authoritarian. Mm-hmm. We're in a position now where an independent physician can barely make it on the outside, and we've lost more and more every year. I think we're down to somewhere around 30% independent physicians left. So there's a conception that, you know, this is out of our control, economically as well as in some ways medically, that, you know, we can just become a part of a larger system. And in many ways, physicians have abdicated responsibility. I sort of adhere to a credo that you are responsible for everything all the time. And as long as people think that way, then we all contribute and we all put something into the system and we all take responsibility for our actions and our patients. And again, going back to this kind of concept of reductionism, you know, the specialist, I refer somebody on to a specialist, and the specialist says, hey, well, you know, I did my thing. You know, I scoped them or I did whatever, didn't find the problem. Good luck with the patient. I mm-hmm. got paid. I'm going to keep moving. Mm-hmm. That sort of idea, this sort of loss of responsibility for the patient has come about really through this third-party payer system. In insurance, I think the idea of insurance is it spreads risk, but it also really spreads responsibility. Nobody steps up and takes personal responsibility for the patients anymore. And that's really where family practice kind of, that's where the rubber hits the road, because we have to, as physicians, take personal responsibility for our patients or nothing gets done, because the system has become so large and so impersonal and run by hospitals, which are working under a profit motive, that patients just get lost in the shuffle. Somebody has to step up and take care of these people, or they just don't get the kind of care that they need.
Oh, I'm noticing that big time. To me, there's a two-tier system that's developed, and it's the private practice independent physician model versus corporate hospital-based accountable care organization type of medical practices. And one, you're going to get what you offer and what I offer, which is the doctor takes the lead. You see your doctor. They know you. Versus a clinic-based situation where you might get a physician assistant, nurse practitioner, never meet the doctor, just get managed, even by phone, where you never even see the person, you just get stuff called in. And it's a completely different mentality. And I think patients, I think they don't get as good, like, I don't, by definition, they don't get as good a treatment plan or care. But patients also have to take responsibility, Nick, don't you think? If you want, you know, Walmart-based medicine, that's what you're going to get. If you want to pay a little bit of copay, call in the prescription. When I say that I have a sore throat, just call me in an antibiotic and you just do it. That's what you've asked for it. Now you got it too.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. But there's a double-edged sword with this, because part of this has become, you know, the way that medicine has sort of shaped itself really based upon the economic factors in medicine. And again, this third-party payer system that removes the deliverer of services, the provider, as you will, which is not a term I'm very happy with, because I'm not a provider, I'm a physician, actually, but where the physician and the patient are no longer connected, but there's this big looming intermediary, you know, which is the insurance company that separates the buyer of the services from the seller of the services. So one thing that becomes crucial to this entire mix is a patient does not have the ability to assess value, because they really don't know the cost of things. And so if we are a society that works at arm's length transactions, and we say that we rely upon competition in the marketplace to produce efficiencies, and then we take, you know, 17% of our GDP and say we're not going to allow free market principles to operate here, and then complain because it's inefficient, I mean, I think that's just an impossible situation to have. But by the same token, this arm's length economic transaction creates an arm's length personal transaction. Mm-hmm. So I don't have the opportunity, if I'm practicing in that system, to look a patient in the eye and say, hey, man, you got to lose 40 pounds or, you know, this is going to kill you. You know, your blood sugar's climbing, your blood pressure's climbing. How many more medicines do you want to take? How many more chronic diseases do you want to add on to this when the simple fact is your diet is terrible, you don't exercise, you're carrying an extra 40 pounds around. You know, so you have to have a personal relationship with somebody to get them invested not only in you and what you're doing, but to get them invested in themselves.
I think that's very important. Personal responsibility comes into play, definitely on the patient side, but also on the doctor side. I absolutely agree with you. The third-party payer system is the death knell to the doctor-patient relationship. But doctors also have to pay, you know, take responsibility for living in fear. I remember when I first opened my practice, there was a rush towards joining insurance companies because the thought was if you didn't join, you wouldn't get a patient. And we didn't read the contracts. We didn't look at the reimbursements. And it just became you were just a serf on this, you know, working the farm for the insurance company. I've gotten a lot more savvy after getting dinged multiple times. I redact things on the contract. I won't sign them. I will leave an insurance company if it becomes, you know, a wedge. I mean, they all do, but I mean, there's different versions of a wedge between you and your patient and the ability to stay open. Is that something that you do? You take insurance in your practice?
Well, I mean, I've seen a lot of models where people tried to deal without insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen anybody that has been completely successful in that because the insurance companies do control such a large portion of the population that it's almost impossible to do business without them. So you have to find some kind of a hybrid that will allow you to deal with the insurance companies, maintain some kind of autonomy, but you also really want to look forward to that group of people who are, that you can deal with outside of an insurance company that allows you to just treat them in a fee-for-service manner so that you can have a direct relationship. So at this point, I haven't found a situation or an economic delivery model yet that really allows people to, or to allows a physician to work outside of the insurance companies.
It's, I think, you know, under this new healthcare system that we're entering or have entered this year, there may be a larger percentage of people who fall into that category. And they're covered, technically, but it costs so much money that they won't be able to access their insurance. You know, we're talking about $6,000 out of pocket, $10,000 out of pocket. I foresee, and I've talked about this at length, that you can, just because you have health insurance, doesn't mean you're going to be able to access health care. And those patients are going to need someplace to go that they can actually see a doctor and not end up in a pipeline, a clinic, where it's just algorithm-driven. Those that are savvy enough to know that this is not healthcare, they're going to need some place to go. And I think, you know, your model offers that. I noticed that on your website that you actually list the prices for your service. It's completely transparent, which I think is the future of medical care.
Well, I think, again, it's this concept of a patient be able to assess value.
Mm-hmm.
Value is key in any transaction. And really, you have to let patients vote with their feet. The insurance company have captives. They don't have patients. They have a captive audience that they will force into whatever physician that they can contract the best rate with. This is not the best thing for the patients. But let's go back for a minute and look at what insurance is. Insurance is designed to keep you from going through bankruptcy if you have a major medical issue. It's designed to keep you from losing your house or losing your car. We know that you will have medical problems over the course of your life. In the same way that we know that you'll have a dental problem, or the same way that we know that your car is going to require an oil change. So the idea of insurance should be in place to prevent a major catastrophic event from happening, a financial catastrophic event, and to take care of you if you do have a major medical issue. Everything else up to that point is a healthcare financing scheme, and you're leaving a lot of money on the table.
Oh, yeah.
So we don't insure our cars for oil changes. Just like you can't really insure yourself for a checkup with the doctor for a cold. And if you looked at it that way and you said, hey, you know, I have this great plan and I don't even have a deductible, so I can go see the doctor, you know, whenever I want and not have to pay anything. Well, and that's going to cost you, you know, $1,500 a month. So you've gone through a year, you haven't even seen the doctor because you haven't had to, and you've shelled out $18,000. I mean, are you crazy? So a lot of times what happened is the employer had paid for these plans. So the patients have no idea really the cost of anything, really, and that's costing everybody for those, for to have that kind of care, and it removes the, the buyer of services from the deliverer of services, and it just sort of short-circuits the entire transaction.
I think you stated that brilliantly. I couldn't have said it better. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that wellness and prevention is the key to living a long and healthy life? For example, common diseases such as acid reflux, high cholesterol, non-insulin-dependent diabetes, and high blood pressure in some cases are caused by poor nutrition. Scientific studies suggest the use of nutritional supplements, a healthy diet, and exercise can control and, in some cases, prevent disease. Use nutritional supplements that are formulated using good manufacturer practice standards. And remember to let your doctor know what you are taking, since it can react with prescription medication. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're on the phone today with Dr. Nicholas Beaulieu from the Highland Personal Health and Highland Urgent Care. He's the owner of both of those entities. And before the break, he made an amazing statement that just crystallized everything that's wrong with the insurance industry and with third-party payers. I mean, Nick, I've been talking about this for like 3 years, and you just managed to distill it down to like one sentence. It was awesome. So that whole analogy of paying up to $18,000 just for a head cold, when you put it like that, it's really obvious. And it's too bad that Congress didn't figure this thing out, because it would have cost everybody so much less if they'd gone back or really take a step back to what insurance used to be, which was catastrophic coverage. People pay for their office visits and out-of-pocket for labs, etc. And then they use the money from the insurance company for big-ticket items. In your opinion, is that the main driver of why this thing is so expensive, aside from graft, you know, leaving that out?
Well, I think we have there's two issues here. One is private insurance, and then the next one really is public insurance. And I'm going to take this back to this concept of responsibility. And I'll say it again. We are responsible for everything all the time, and that's, you have to start from that premise. And the idea of a government payer or even an insurance company as a payer abdicates responsibility between the physician and the patient. And when there's no longer that arm's length transaction where you have to look somebody in the eye and say, hey, I'm really going to overcharge you, you know, on this procedure, have a great day. And the patient says, hey, well, really, thank you for overcharging me. You know, this wouldn't happen if we looked people in the eye and we told them what it cost. And the patient said, well, you know, I shopped this, and I can get this for this down the street. Well, if you're going to stay in business, you're going to say, well, I can match that price, or, you know, I'm going to have to close my doors. So this short-circuiting of the basic capitalist principles that we operate our country under is really what has got us into the situation. Now take the extreme of that. We have an insensitive organization like the federal government who is really responsible for about 60% of all payments in health care. And then you have people who are just set out to defraud them, be that an insurance company or a crooked physician or, you know, whatever, you know, middleman in the industry that can take that money. And that really just compounds the problem. We're essentially just hemorrhaging money because we do not have arm's length transactions where we look each other in the eye and we do this. And I think that really happened, I think, in a huge way when Medicare started in the mid-60s. That was a huge issue, and I think a lot of doctors took advantage of that situation, and it kind of set the tone for where medicine was going from there on out.
So basically, it was a lot of gaming the system, and unfortunately, you know, the bad apples pretty much spoiled it for everybody else, because you're assumed to be a criminal now, that you're trying to game the system, that you're trying to commit a crime, and so you're guilty until proven innocent. And the new rules that have come through HHS and IRS, et cetera, are really very scary. It's one of the main reasons that I had to leave Medicaid and Medicare, because you're if you do run afoul of the law or the rule, they assume you did it on purpose. It's never by accident now. You have to prove that it was an accident. It's impossible. And you'll get closed down before you have a chance to even mount a defense, if you could afford to do so. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I agree. When I first opened my practice 10 years ago, I looked at taking Medicare, and I saw the first few patients. I waited months for payment, and the payment came, and it was minuscule. It, you know, it was a $30 or $40 or a $50 payment on, really, I know my bottom line is I really need to make about $100 a patient to keep my doors open. So I could see right away that I was losing money, but with every check came the statement that said, we vigorously pursue fraud, you know, and we're, and they just tell you with every check that came that we are coming after you if you make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a no-brainer for me. I looked at that and I said, well, let me see, you're paying me less than I need to even make a living, and if I make a mistake on this billing, you're gonna prosecute me. The threat of a Medicare audit would essentially shut my practice down. I just am not deep enough or have deep enough pockets to defend myself against the federal government. So within the first 6 weeks of being open and getting my first Medicare check, I decided, whoa, this is not economically viable for me to even participate with the government. And that was the last time I ever did, and that was 10 years ago.
I totally understand. And they even have an outreach to the patients that, like, if you see something, say something kind of outreach. If you're unhappy with your doctor, you report them and you'll get a percentage of what we claw back. It's pretty amazing. I mean, talk about an adversarial relationship that they try to develop between the doctor and the patient. And that's another thing that I've noticed over the course of my 12 years in practice, 13, that the insurance company actively baits the patient to see their doctor as the enemy, to see their doctor as somebody who's working against them, trying to game them, trying to steal from them, and they're the ones doing it. And at this point now, I'm getting EOBs, explanation of benefits, or I should say denials, saying that it's not medically necessary as per insurance rule. Forget about American Academy of Otolaryngology. Forget about, you know, what we know as the state of the art for practice. They now get to decide what medically necessary is. Now, that to me is a major switch that really lets us know as physicians, we don't run our show anymore. If they have anything to say about it, it will be the third-party payer. Right now it's the private insurance company, but I believe that we're moving towards single payer. You know, whether it's de facto, de jure, we're moving that way. And when the government steps in, if Medicare is any indication, it won't be a doctor-patient relationship anymore, and we'll be following algorithms or we won't practice.
Whoa, this is, you know, that's an accurate and loaded statement. So let me do my best not to go on for an hour on this, so feel free to interrupt me. But I would say one of the main things that we see with an insurance company that just incenses me beyond belief is that they are trying to say we want to pay for performance and we want to see these parameters met. And so what they're saying is we are going to create efficiency in medicine by driving this from the top. And I think what they're trying to do is legitimize their presence. They have no reason to even be here in primary care. You know, if a patient has to see a doctor because they have an issue, you know, be it a head cold to a broken bone, that's a transaction that should occur between a patient and a physician. Unless it gets in a very high dollar situation where we need to invoke insurance, then yes, that's exactly why we have insurance. And that's why we're setting these deductibles at $3,500, $3,600, these high deductible plans, because that's really what makes sense. You know, if you can max out a credit card, borrow the money from your mother, whatever it takes, but you want to pay $200 a month for a high deductible plan and not $800 a month for a plan that gives you, you know, 2-3 visits with your doctor. Look at the amount of money you've just left on the table right there. So the insurance companies are trying to legitimize their presence at this point in time by saying we are going to produce efficiency by putting all these metrics in front of these doctors. And really they can't. The only way to produce efficiency in a marketplace is to allow free market principles to function. I mean, Adam Smith is rolling over in his grave right now. We base this entire country on economic principles that go back to, you know, the Wealth of Nations and his work from, you know, the English Industrial Revolution. And now we've removed so much of our economy from basic economic principles. And I think the insurance companies already know that they're anachronism. They are going away. And they're really struggling, and I think desperately, to prove that they have some worth in this system when they don't. I think that they have worth over $3,500 in expenditure, the kind of things that we have insurance for. But for them to try to create efficiency from top down by telling physicians how to practice medicine is about the most inefficient system you could possibly imagine. And I would just love to see them go away along with all of the other middlemen. We know that about 40% of every healthcare dollar goes to an insurance company. And at this point in time, 20-something percent of an insurance company's budget is for marketing. They're all trying to put it out there. You see the amount of insurance company media on the radio, on the television, how they're trying to present themselves as benign entities when they're nothing but pecunious. They exist only for their own profit and really with no regard for the patients. Now, I would say Kaiser is a good model because there's some efficiency in there, and I think Kaiser has a great advertising campaign, and everybody is really trying to play catch-up with them. But I don't see a future for insurance companies at all. I do think that we are moving towards a single-payer system, and I embrace that in a lot of ways because we are the only country in the world who has a for-profit medical system. And for that reason, we're spending two or three times the next closest country. And our mortality rates and our life expectancy is right behind Colombia, you know, who spends almost a fifth of what we spend. So you can see that there is so much money that is funneled out of direct patient care into just an army of middlemen. All the money is going out. So I think President Obama had to embrace the insurance companies because their lobbies are so strong. But the movement in the Affordable Care Act that works in conjunction with the insurance companies, I think it's a political necessity, but I think it really is a great diversion. Eventually, the government probably will have to take over healthcare, and I welcome that concept because now we can provide basic services to people who otherwise have no means to get healthcare, and that is great. So the minute that happens, the system splits, as it has done in every other country around the world. We have a public system that can provide basic care. Then maybe we have tiers of insurance for what other services that you think you might want to entertain, or you pay out of pocket for the rest of it. The minute patients start paying out of pocket for their care and they have some skin in the game, there will be efficiency created in this industry because now you're going to have to look somebody in the eye and tell them the price. The patients are going to be able to assess value, and they're going to vote with their feet. That is the only thing that will create efficiency in this marketplace, not some mandate coming down from the government or from an insurance company about what should or shouldn't be done.
I know we have a disagreement on this one, but I would say the way you have described the system depends on a lot of factors, and one is that doctors remain free. That means they don't have their licensure tied to taking the universal health care, that they don't have peer review and other maintenance of certification and other punitive, costly, you know, yokes that make sure that they toe the line. So there has to be an allowed free market in order for what you just said, in my belief, in my opinion, to work. So Canada doesn't have that, and a lot of Canadian docs left Canada and came to the United States. The UK does have it, and they have a two-tier system. But, you know, my dad lived in a socialized country with universal health care, and yeah, they do have a two-tier system for people who don't have money go into the public health system and those that don't pay private. But the people who go into the public system die. They get substandard care. They have to wait forever to see the doctor. Then they don't have enough medication and there's shortages. So how can we find, I don't know if that system works. I haven't seen it work beautifully in any of the developed countries. I mean,
I think it's great that we have some disagreements on this point because I think it's going to allow us to sort of tease out really what our own opinions are and present this for the listener.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is a necessity of the government, and I'm going to just put this plainly, and this may not be attractive to anybody, but we cannot do everything for everybody all of the time. Healthcare is a limited resource, and as such, it will have to be rationed. That's just the bottom line. There is no resource that's unlimited. So we are probably not going to be able to save 400 grand babies. We're probably not going to be able to replace hips in 95-year-old people. There are certain procedures that somebody can get if they can pay for, but they are not a right. So we have to look at this and take a hard look at it. This is part of the problem with our system, is that we do everything for everybody all of the time. Mm. And there is so much unreimbursed care out there that it places a burden on the rest of the system. One of the things, and I think probably the major savings that is presented by a government-sponsored and universal health care system, is that they can legitimately ration services. In this country, we have no mechanism to ration services because it's political suicide for any politician to talk about this, to even discuss it. So this is the elephant in the room that nobody will discuss. We cannot, you know, put all of these resources into, and what we're going to see is all our money goes in the first 6 months of life and in the last 6 months of life. So we have to put our money where it's valuable. There are certain people we are not going to be able to save, and there are certain procedures that won't be done when people go beyond a certain age unless they can pay for them themselves. We have no mechanism in this current system that allows us to make that distinction or to present that to the patients. And the only legitimate entity that will ever be able to do that is the federal government. And for that reason, we have to have them involved in the system, if for nothing else. Now, the other piece of this is, if this is just a fee-for-service and capitalist system, mm-hmm. as we know, sometimes capitalism is a zero-sum game. There are people who are outperformed, and there are people who just, you know, it's a competitive system. Some people are not going to make it. Now, my idea is not to discard those people. We have to provide for them because we cannot create a permanent underclass. And a system that doesn't exist without government benefits will provide a permanent underclass and a constant reservoir of disease. So we have to address that population as well. There probably is not a mechanism in a completely free market that addresses that population. And in my mind, that's where the government steps in to do that. However, if the government is the purchaser of services on the free market, they don't do a very good job of it. And that's what we have right now with Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA system. They are purchasing services in a capitalist sort of system, and they're getting nailed left and right. And they're trying to modify the system, but all it does is dilute out the free market principles that are required for that system to operate efficiently.
Well, you know, I think there's been a movement towards conflating capitalism and cronyism. And that's, you know, people are demonizing capitalism as if it's the worst thing in the world, but in actuality, this is all cronyism. Gone amok, run amok. I mean, these guys all collude. The insurance companies talk to the pharmacy companies, talk to the, you know, the pharmacies. They decide what medication is going to be covered for this month, this year. Who's going to make what profit off of what? The restriction of trade. You know, all sorts of illegal activity is going on. It's not capitalism that's going on. It's the fact, you're right. Money's flowing to Washington, people turn the other way, they get paid off, and they let this ride. And the patients and the doctors are the ones that are sitting here holding, holding the what's left, you know, the garbage that they want to, you know, foist on us. But I don't think it's capitalism per se. I think you're right. If you have competition, fair competition. Look, I'm a surgeon. So let's talk about surgery centers here in Atlanta, for example. It's much cheaper to take a patient to a surgery center than it is to take them to a hospital by about two-thirds. What the hospitals were allowed to do in Georgia were to say, oh, poor us, we can't handle the competition, nobody should be allowed to open up any more, you know, independent surgery centers because we won't be able to stay open. And they were able to pass legislation to stop the opening of private independent surgery centers. And then they proceeded to buy up everything they could and put it out of business. So now all you have is like two or three in the entire Atlanta area, independent surgery centers, or you have to go to a big surgery center. So they're basically removed. It's a monopoly. They removed their competition, but that's not capitalism. They got an in from the government, from the local government, paid them off, and then everybody's happy. And then we have to see, you know, I'm sure you do too, when you were, you know, within the hospital system, you have to see a certain amount of patients who are for free. And the hospitals get reimbursed for that, but the private independent surgery centers don't. So it's a double standard. And so they make sure that the game is hard, and that's why there's 30% of us left. But it's not a fair game. It's not capitalism. It's completely rigged. And this is why the costs are so high.
No, I mean, those are excellent points that you make. There's no question. And I think I'm hoping that if the government takes their piece of it, then they leave the rest of us alone to actually be effective and to practice medicine. And so then that safety net is there. And I think that that's, you know, and believe me, I am a capitalist to the core. But there's some sort of a compassionate capitalism in here somewhere where we do provide a safety net for those among us who are outcompeted or otherwise don't have the opportunities. And that's sort of where I'm coming from. My vision of a public health system where the government is a provider is quite small. The rest of it now, I'm just saying, please take the governor off us in private practice and in a private industry, and the governor in terms of like what would limit your speed limit, but also the government in terms of those of that regulation so that we can get on with an efficient model. And so that's sort of my hope with this public payer system, that it remains relatively small and most of us don't have to interface with it. To your point about the hospitals, I'm sitting here day in and day out trying to make a living and to run a practice as efficiently as I can, but I'm competing with a hospital who has hired up most of the docs and has the resources that pays no taxes. So right from the get-go, there's 40% of my income that is gone, and really closer to 50% if you look at the other taxes that I'm paying. And I'm competing with a hospital that doesn't pay taxes.
Wow.
You know, and they're complaining that the field is not level. I mean, this kills me that I have to compete with these guys, and they don't have near the tax burden that I have, and they have all of these other situations. If I take care of a patient for free or I don't get paid, then that's just money I lose.
Mm-hmm.
The hospital will complain about the indigent patients all day long as they take billions of dollars in federal money to take care of indigent patients, where I can't even write off my losses, you know, where the hospital even gets reimbursed, let alone writing off a loss.
I know.
So, I mean, it is such an unlevel playing field. And it's they've destroyed the private medicine in this country, and most of the docs have had to go to work for them, and man, they are miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And they would leave in a heartbeat if there was any other system. My hope is that I can weather the storm, remain viable, looking at novel economic delivery models for medicine, and until the smoke clears on this and people really come to their senses and figure out what this thing is about. I mean, that's really my hope.
I, you know, from your lips to God's ears, and, you know, as long as I'm in practice, I'm going to make sure that we both stay open and that we both get the word out, that people don't have to settle. I mean, I've said this on the show before, that people, you know, if you don't expect enough, you know, if you don't love yourself enough to demand that somebody care about you and not even look in your eye, not just type on a computer, and that's okay with you, then there's a problem there. I want my physician, it's about the art of medicine, as much as it's about the science, and that means talking to them, touching them, examining them, actually going through the entire physical process of intake, not having somebody else do it for you. I mean, I've gone through these places where you've got an MA to input your name and your, you know, your demographic information. Somebody else comes in and does the vitals. You're sitting there for another half an hour. The doctor comes in, reads the computer, basically. I don't even think, you know, there's no exam going on, but the diagnosis is made, basically. And you get a prescription that's electronically sent to your pharmacy. That's not healthcare. That's not medicine. Now, I want to shift our conversation because you're a functional medical doctor. Can you just explain to people, because to me, this is what medicine should be and what savvy and really good doctors are moving towards.
Sure. So let me say a little bit about this and kind of, and I'll transition this by going back to what we're talking about, this protocol medicine. So we have these things called practice guidelines that, you know, I know you probably just, I raised your blood pressure 10 points
you
even
did.
Mentioning that word.
Yep.
But so this is this idea where if you have this parameter or if you have this disease, you should give this drug or you should do this treatment. Now, the most important concept in this is that people have the same disease, but they arrive at it in a different way. For that reason, a drug that works for one person may not work for another and might kill the third. That's why we don't do cookbook medicine. We don't do protocols. We know who our patients are. We understand how they got to their disease and exactly what their disease is. We're not opening a book and following an algorithm. Now, a computer can do that. This, again, is the art of medicine. People have accepted the fact that they will have a series of issues over their life or diseases, and have to take medication for them and continue to take more and more medication, and that there is never really a cure sought for the disease, but only symptom management, only a pill to relieve a symptom, pain, or whatever the issue might be, and they have accepted that, and most physicians have accepted that. I will not accept that, and there's a variety of patients who will not accept it either. So we go back to look at what is the cause of disease. We are constantly trying to move upstream. What's the cause? What's the cause? What's the cause? Is it genetic? Is it environmental? Is it a toxicity? And this is what functional medicine is about. We are going back into the biochemistry of the disease to try to find a cure rather than to say, yeah, it's a chronic disease, live with it, take this, it will make you feel a little bit better. We're going to slowly watch you wind down. That is not the curve that we're looking for, that slow wind down. I want you to feel the best that you possibly can, and my hope is that every organ you have fails within 5 minutes of each other so that you drop off completely and you die peacefully in your sleep, like my grandfather, not the people in the other car, as we say. So I think that going back and getting the cure is really what the Holy Grail was in medicine all the time. But it's become a factory production line where we manage symptoms. And if you look at the players in the field, as long as there is disease, there will be drugs. And as long as there is disease, there will be insurance companies. So now you're looking at collusion at the highest levels at the top, where who is developing these protocols? Well, I'm sure that the pharmaceutical industry has a lot to say about it because they're funding most of the studies. And so they don't really deliver the data. They deliver surrogate endpoints, and they bury a study if it doesn't show what they want them to. And then they negotiate with insurance companies about what drugs the insurance company will pay. And boom, you develop a protocol that really has very little to do with the patient and very little to do with the medicine. In functional medicine, we're going to go back to look at a variety of parameters. What's the nutritional status of the patient? What is their genetics? Try to find what was the collusion of elements in the environment related to that person's individual genetics that really set them up for that disease. And we try to go back and address those concerns because we really don't want chronic disease. We are really looking for cure. And that requires a really active partnership on the part of the physician and the patient. The biggest obstacle to the delivery of this kind of care is the economics. We really need to see about 4 patients an hour to be financially viable in medicine as it's set up. When I got into functional medicine 6 or 7 years ago and started to look at it, I realized that this is not a viable model of medicine because it can't be delivered under the current system. So what I have done since that point in time is just to sort of look at different economic delivery models for this form of medicine, and I eventually settled on concierge for that reason, because you're paid a retainer fee up front. So now you're not looking at your watch when you're talking to a patient to make sure that you can see 3 more patients in the next hour or you're not going to be able to pay your light bill. You get your money up front so that you can take the time that you need with your patient to figure things out. My physical exam is a 2-hour event. I'm going to spend about 2 hours looking you in the eye, talking to you, finding family history, environmental influences, and trying to decide what is the basis of the disability so that we can find an answer and solve the entire problem. So for me, it's twofold. Is we have this wonderful medicine, functional medicine, that really, really can do a lot for people. But then how are we able to deliver that in this economic environment? And so I have opted to blend a functional medicine approach to the patient with a concierge model that allows me to achieve both of those goals.
I think that's just an amazing model. I think it's what independent doctors should move towards. I mean, talk about a difference in mindset and difference in track. What the next medicine that you're going to take to counter the side effect of the medicine that you're currently on, or the method of find out what the problem is, fix it, you know, keep yourself off of medication and keep yourself healthy. Now, I just want to actually pick your brain for a second about the genetic aspect of disease. I know you've heard about, you know, Angelina Jolie having a gene for breast cancer, and so she underwent a palliative, you know, preemptive double mastectomy. You know, functional medicine, in my opinion, and correct me if I'm wrong, that probably wouldn't have had to happen because you would be looking at something deeper than just a gene, right? It would have been, what other metabolic things can we do to try to alleviate, you know, it's not, how can I put it this way? Just because it's in your genes doesn't mean you're going to get it. correct?
Exactly. So we have this concept of genotype, what is in your genes, in phenotype, what is actually expressed. Now, breast cancer is sort of an interesting microcosm here. Now we're going to say that somewhere between 1 in 8 and 1 in 12 women are going to have a brush with breast cancer over the course of their lives. I mean, that's just a fascinating statistic. If we broke this down and said, not to look at that statistic and say that this is inevitable, but let's move upstream on that and try to decide what's going on. So let's look at it from this perspective. A breast is mostly fat. Fat, you know, we are a liquid-based system, so we have fats and we have liquid in our body, and the two don't mix very well. In the same way with our exterior chemical environment, we have fat-soluble chemicals and we have water-soluble chemicals. Well, there's really has been the introduction of 85,000 new chemicals registered with the FDA since World War II. So we are literally swimming in an environment that is just bathed in hydrocarbon, artificially produced chemicals that your body never developed any system to detoxify from. Where do hydrocarbons go? Well, they are fat-loving or what we say lipophilic. So they are going to go into fat tissues. Well, even the thinnest woman will have breasts, and so she's going to concentrate any toxins from her environment in her breast. Look at another factor as well. If you look at these bisphenol A, this liner of every tin can, this plasticizer that's found in every plastic, bisphenol A was originally developed as a synthetic estrogen in the 1930s. It was not a very effective estrogen, and it was put on the shelf until it was brought back in the 1950s as a plasticizer because it helps make plastics more malleable. We lined every tin can with it. You know, we put it all throughout our environment, and this is a synthetic estrogen. Now we have girls who are going through puberty at 9 years of age. We have this rash of breast cancer. We have a lot of males who show more feminine characteristics. Are we swimming in estrogen? Mm-hmm. Estrogen is 1,000 times more potent than testosterone. It's a very, very tiny molecule with incredible potency. And now we have essentially put this throughout our entire environment. It's a steroid-based hormone, so it is fat-soluble as well. So why don't we look at why we have so much breast cancer? The genetics are important, but what is going on in our environment and what is going on in our fat tissue? And it's concentrating a lot of environmental toxins. This is sort of what functional medicine is about. Keep moving upstream. Keep asking the questions. Keep asking the questions and know your patients.
That's my method, too. I love that. Now, one of the other major organs, I just want people to understand your mindset. And another organ system that I wanted to touch base with or on is the GI tract. I mean, a lot of people are now all of a sudden, you know, the big companies are on bandwagon about probiotics and Greek yogurt and digestive enzymes, but they're a little late to the table. The GI tract is actually one of the most important organ systems that we have because it helps us. It's a barrier. It helps metabolize our food stuff. So it actually the area where things come across and actually we feed ourselves. But what else is important about it? I've heard connections between autism, between mental disease and poor GI function.
Well, to me, this is, and as a primary care, I'm not going to bust on the specialist too much, but really I feel like the gastroenterologists hold all of medicine in their hands. The GI tract is their purview, and they don't even know it. They don't realize it. If you think about your GI tract, at any one point in time, you have 6 to 7 pounds of bacteria living in that tract. That is a necessity for us. We have evolved over time to develop these bacteria in our bowel, which are essentially a separate organ system unto themselves. They help synthesize our vitamins, they help break down our foods, and very importantly, they educate our immune system about what is self and what is foreign. 80% of your immune system lines your GI tract. And if we sit here and constantly assault the GI tract from overuse of antibiotics by physicians, antibiotics in our food supply, antibiotics permeating our environment, that organ system is under constant attack. When that organ system malfunctions, you are going to feel the consequences of it. Look at the amount of autoimmune disease mm-hmm. that we have. Most likely, autoimmune disease is going to originate in the gut with dysbiotic or upset bacterial populations that are there. We know that if we can correct the bacterial populations in the gut, we can limit a lot of autoimmune disease. For everything from, irritable bowel syndrome, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's disease typically do respond in one fashion or another to probiotics. Also, if you look at the amount of dermatitis and skin conditions, really, the skin that lines your GI tract is not much different than the skin on the outside of your body. inflammation on the inside of your body and that skin is probably going to manifest as inflammation on the outside of your body and that skin in the form of eczema, psoriasis, all of these conditions. So there's been a greater recognition of the necessity of a healthy GI tract, which, again, is the origin, the assimilation of all nutrition and the expulsion of all toxins happens at that surface, at that level. So the GI tract, I consider to be, if you're going to be a reductionist and break the human body down, one of the most crucial of all organ systems. And it's like the gastroenterologists are looking in the wrong direction. They're making too much money doing scoping people and, you know, and just making probably one of the higher paid specialists. There's just a status quo in that field that doesn't really accept some of the newer concepts around the GI tract and probiotics and that. So I think there's a slow assimilation of that information. It's not all GI doctors, but in general, I've been disappointed at how little regard they have shown for, you know, for this concept.
I understand. Now, I just wanted to have you expand a little bit about your practice. I know Highland Personal Health is the newest venture, but you also have Highland Urgent Care. And tell me, tell our listeners about each one. I mean, can they, are both practices open that you're seeing new patients?
Yes. We have Highland Personal Health is that concierge practice that is functional medicine based. And that's where I have, you know, a personal interaction with each patient that's there. I've limited the patient population. That population is going to be capped at about 200 patients, and I'm about two-thirds of the way there, but certainly we are accepting new patients. And we are that practice I do along the lines of functional medicine. I know that, you know, and that is $1,600 a year. That's a big pill for a lot of people to swallow, and I understand that. But I also have a sense of personal responsibility to my community as well as being a businessman. And so when I realize that the personal health is not for everybody, there's a newer model that's evolving in medicine, and I really hope that many physicians can embrace this. And let me just take a minute to explain this. There's a model called direct pay, and in this model, you essentially become a member of a practice. So it's, and our practice is known as the Health Alliance. So in order to become a member, we would take a monthly fee out. You belong to it like you belong to a gym. It's a $60 a month fee. And for that fee, you would get access to an electronic medical record that's cloud-based, so you have access to your records all the time. It provides a secure means of communication with the practice so that you can email back and forth for the, to the practice, be it for a prescription refill or to ask a question. And for that $60 a month, it also includes three visits a year. One of those is a physical exam with all lab studies, EKG, the physical that it would be provided at any doctor's office, and that's about a $400 value for those labs. Now, you get that and two other visits. Each visit, we bill out at $120 a visit, which is cheaper than most places, mm-hmm. but it's still a fair price. It allows us to make a profit and to stay in practice. You get two more visits on top of that. So for that $60 a month, there's that three visits, including the physical exam, and then 50% off all other services. If you needed a chest x-ray, which is $80, that would be $40. If you wanted a fourth visit, which is $120, that would be $60. Now, when we combine this monthly fee with a high-deductible health plan that kicks in at $3,600 a year in expenditure, that's coordinated actually through an outside insurance company. But when we combine this monthly membership model with that high-deductible plan, that is ACA compliant. Mm-hmm. That's a compliant with the Affordable Health Care Act and satisfies the individual mandate. So really, I like to look at this as an alternative to Obamacare because we are providing exactly what they're asking for, but we're not doing it in a way that says, get this and everything will be well, because I am not going to accept the Obamacare plans, and I don't know of many physicians who are, because we just don't really know what's going to happen. And none of us really trust the government because they really don't have our interests in mind. They're controlled by forces that are much greater than the individual physician. So what I'm saying is that you can get, for $60 a month and getting a high-deductible plan, you have first-dollar coverage and you have catastrophic coverage, and you actually have a practice where you will be seen. And we will guarantee that we can see you within 24 hours, whatever your problem is. And we have extended hours as well. We're soon to go to be open 12 hours a day, and we're entertaining opening on the weekends. So there is a healthcare source where you're going to be able to get whatever care that you need at an affordable price. And I think this is exactly what President Obama is asking everybody to have. But we as physicians have to do this from a grassroots level, from the ground up, because I think it's going to be demonstrated over and over again that the powers that be, the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry, do not have the patient's interest in mind. It is the individual physicians who remain independent that truly do.
I think it's just extremely elegantly stated, and I think we should learn our lesson on this. If we sit back and let it be crafted by an outside source, non-physician, we're not going to like what's going to come down the pipe. This is our last chance, I think, to carve out medicine the way you and I trained, and those of us who love the doctor-patient relationship, who practice old-school medicine and actually futuristic medicine with functional medicine. That's the only way we can save ourselves, is to actually provide a viable third track. And this is it. Patients aren't spending a ton of money. I mean, people are going to be sorely disappointed when they start coming out of $900, $1,200 out of pocket, and they have to wait to see their doctor or go to the clinic and see the doctor or be denied, you know, their x-ray because it's deemed not medically necessary. All those things are those problems are not taken care of under Obamacare, but just siphoning like a hose in your pocket, taking money out, is actually the only thing I can see that it's very good at doing.
Yeah, well, I think that if there are enough physicians, we don't need to reinvent the wheel to recreate this health system.
Mm-hmm.
The system exists, and the patients are asking for what they want. We've been stifled in so many directions that we can't even deliver what patients are asking for because of the insurance companies. We have to get outside of this just suffocating weight of the insurance industry to be able to provide effective care to patients. Patients have to understand that concept, that we are crippled in terms of our ability to deliver medicine because we have no economic delivery models left. So we have to continue to fight to come up with new and innovative delivery models for healthcare. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm looking at different ways. How do we deliver this economically to make it cost-effective and to deliver good care? And I have just continued to bang my head against the wall and look for openings. And I really feel like the direct pay model is a great opening for the average physician to be able to come out and get a sustainable income where they know exactly what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that with an insurance company, you know, they're going to deny about 30% of what I bill. You know, they're going to hold up my payments. You know, so I cannot viably run a business if I have no income stream or even know what that number is going to be. A direct pay model where patients are paying monthly allows us to plan in the way every business needs to plan, for lean times or for expenses and those kind of things. And so I encourage every physician to look at this model because it's a membership-based model that gets buy-in from the patients as well as the physician. So we work in a partnership towards somebody's health rather than having an insurance company insinuate themselves between us.
So, Nick, what's the best way for people to reach you?
My website is www.hucfm.com. That's Highland Urgent Care and Family Medicine.com. Then you'll see Highland Personal Health is attached to that as well. And more information regarding the direct pay option will be on there. This model actually rolls out February 1st for us. We sort of coincided. We wanted to wait this first month of Obamacare and just kind of see how things shook out. And really, it's amazing how little fanfare there's been. But our direct pay model and that information will be available on the website within the next 2 weeks.